This year is proving quite the lesson in the pitfalls of intervention. A matter of weeks after the United States abandoned Afghanistan to the Taliban it had spent 20 years fighting for control of the country, a parliamentary election in Iraq has been won by another indefatigable enemy of an American occupation, the Shiite cleric and militia commander Muqtada al-Sadr. Al-Sadr's Sayrun alliance was already the biggest party in Iraq's parliament, but they appear to have significantly increased their share of seats, and therefore Al-Sadr's influence on Iraq's immediate future. He will not lead Iraq's next government, but nobody will have a greater say in who does. This election was brought forward 6 months as part of a response to huge rolling protests which began in Iraq in late 2019. Protests not really about anything in particular, but everything in general. There is little belief that the Iraqi politicians responsible for Iraq's problems will suddenly locate solutions. In this latest election, nearly three-fifths of eligible voters didn't bother. Nevertheless, someone is going to end up in charge. Is there anything they can do to win back those who've given up on Iraq's politics? And what does Muqtada al-Sadr actually want at this point? This is the Foreign Desk.
It's hard to explain and hard even to understand at times the appeal of religion, which is overlaid over politics. So his followers, and there are vast numbers of his followers, would do anything for him. And there was actually an election official who said, if Sayyid Muqtada asked me to jump off the roof, I would jump off the roof.
Most of Iraqi people just didn't care about this election before, and they don't care about the result now. So they are not surprised at all by the result, and they don't expect anything good and life-changing to come out from it.
If you look at the election result, there are some positive signs. For example, some seats have gone to parties that came out of the protest movements. Also, there are a few, not all, but a few independents that are themselves surprised that they somehow won votes and are now in the parliament. So what you have is this loose coalition of protest-minded, reform-minded, truly independents who are now going to go into the parliament.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, from Baghdad by the journalist Sophia Nitti. Sophia, first of all, let's go back to the days and weeks before the vote. What was the general atmosphere like? Was there much tension around, or did everything go pretty peacefully?
There was not much tension, literally speaking, because the rocket attacks from Shia militias supported by Iran had stopped since a few weeks. But there was a lot of lack of confidence. So we already knew from way before the vote that not much people was meaning to go to actually vote.
On that subject of the turnout, it is low, about 41% is what people are anticipating being the final figure. What was the reason for that? Were there safety concerns that people worried that there might be violence on election day? Or was there something, I guess, deeper than that, kind of an apathy that it didn't really matter and nothing was going to change?
There was a general mistrust toward the Iraqi political system. And so indeed, not going to vote was kind of a strategy from Iraqi people to show to the previous government and in general to the political class, they don't believe in any way in the political system. But also, of course, in a country as Iraq, is usually very, very difficult to convince people to go to vote because this country is undermined by corruption, by the lack of services from the state. And so people not usually go to vote. But also talking about security, as you say, there was a security concern, which was not much about the voting day, but way more about the general ambience before, during all the electoral campaigns. So as we know, this vote was anticipated of 6 months to try to cope with the anger from the demonstrators from October 2019. So this was why the vote was pushed forward. So a lot of political movement which were born from the protests intended to actually go to vote and to propose their candidature. But then since a few months, they decided to boycott this election because there were a lot of independent candidates that were threatened, that faced violence from unknown people, but as we know, more from the Shia militia supported by Iran. So these independent candidates and also the demonstrators supporting them decided not to go to vote and actually to boycott the vote way a few months ago.
Let's look at the results such as they are, that low turnout notwithstanding. It's clearly a very good result for Muqtada al-Sadr. Was that expected?
In a way, yes, because Muqtada al-Sadr movement has already arrived first in the previous election in 2018. The movement got 54 seats in 2018 and they got 73 seats now in this election. So in a way, especially since, as we saw, there was a very, very low turnout, for sure Muqtada al-Sadr supporters were a big part of the voters of last Sunday.
We have heard, since the results have begun to be announced, a certain amount of grouching from a few pro-Iranian parties, most notably the Fatah Alliance. What kind of case are they trying to make there? Have they advanced any serious evidence of any wrongdoing, or are they just bad losers?
Well, no, they didn't show any concrete evidence of bad doing yet. But for sure, they have been putting forward threats, saying that these results are not satisfying, they're not trustful, and they need to be arranged.
As you have alluded to there, these pro-Iranian groups have, to put it charitably, associations with armed militias. Are they making any kind of explicit threat of violence?
So far, there are threats of violence, but not very explicit, and we didn't see a resume of rocket attacks yet. So for the moment, it's just words. But also, we have to consider that for the upcoming weeks and most probably months, Iraq is going to be scattered in the political race to constitute the coalitions and the political groups in the parliament. So everything will depend more on the alliance that the groups and the pro-Iranian militias are going to be able to create.
As you are suggesting there, the process of assembling a new Iraqi government is not likely to be either quick or straightforward. But what actually is the process? What has to happen next?
So Muqtada al-Sadr has arrived first in this electoral race, but still he doesn't have enough seats to create a government by himself. So we are going to see a lot of negotiation and trying to make alliance. So this might take weeks to months. And then, of course, the political groups has to agree on a prime minister, which took months back in 2020 after the resignation of Adel Abdelmahdi in December 2019.
In the meantime, of course, people are still going to be living their lives in Iraq to the extent that that remains possible. What are people you've been speaking to about the election results saying? Is there any optimism at all that anything is going to change, bearing in mind that these elections were, as you said, brought forward in response to protests expressing dissatisfaction with pretty much everything?
Well, of course, it depends much on who we talk with. So, you know, of course, Muqtada al-Sadr supporters were already celebrating on Monday evening in Tahrir Square in the center of Baghdad. So if you speak with them, of course, they will tell you that that's amazing. They're going to be able to do what they wanted to do. But as we mentioned before, most of Iraqi people just didn't care about this election before and they don't care about the result now. So they are not surprised at all by the result and they don't expect anything good and life-changing to come out from it.
Sophia Nitti in Baghdad, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Muqtada al-Sadr was not a candidate for office himself in this election. He has long preferred to exercise his considerable power from the shadows. For a look at his journey to this point, I'm joined now by Jane Arraf, Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. Jane, let's begin with Muqtada al-Sadr's origin story. How did he become a figure in Iraqi politics in the first place?
First of all, I guess I'd say he was born, it's the family he was born into, really. He comes from a revered Shia family. And in 1999, his father, the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sadr, was assassinated, along with his two elder brothers. So that left Muqtada, who was then in his 20s, basically to carry on the family's legacy. 1999, of course, was when Saddam Hussein was still around, and his father, was in the mosques. He was preaching, demanding religious freedom, criticizing Saddam Hussein. And when he was executed, there was a huge uproar in Shia neighborhoods in Baghdad and across the south. So already you have a guy who comes from a place of considerable power and importance just by virtue of the fact that he came from that family.
He became a well-known figure, not just in Iraq, but also globally during the civil war, which followed the United States invasion in 2003. How clearly do we now understand the role that he played? This was, of course, the time when the huge Shia neighborhood of Baghdad, formerly known as Saddam City, was rechristened Sadir City and was regarded with some trepidation even by the most heavily armed foreign troops.
So 2003 comes around and Saddam Hussein is toppled. And it's a whole new ballgame. All these Iraqi exiles come from outside. They come from Iran. They come from London. And they're basically shepherded for the most part by the United States and the U.S. military. And here's Muqtada Sadr, who has remained in Iraq and is even then an Iraqi nationalist. I spoke to a diplomat, a former diplomat, Nabil Khoury, who was in Baghdad in 2003, and he said he was approached by Sadr officials, basically chief advisors. Nabil Khoury speaks Arabic, so he said they approached him because they knew him from TV, and they said, Muqtada Sadr, or Sayyid Muqtada, as Sayyid is a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, would like to be involved in this governing council that you're developing. He wants to be part of this new Iraq. And according to Mr. Khoury, the existing members of the council to be, Ahmed Chalabi and others, said, no, no way, that's a bad idea. And the U.S. followed his advice. So now Muqtada Sadr is on the outside. And as the American invasion turns into an occupation, he forms the Mahdi Army. This is a militia that takes on U.S. troops. And although it's not well equipped and really badly trained, they posed a serious threat to the U.S. Army in Baghdad, in Najaf, in other places. And that was the theme for a few years until we get to the sectarian war, where the Mahdi Army is still around, even stronger. And it's blamed for fueling a large part of the sectarian fighting. So Muqtada Sadr says all the troops weren't under his control. There was a splinter group that broke away. He didn't have anything to do with the violence that went on. And we're talking about death squads. We're talking about sectarian cleansing of neighborhoods. But he is, in fact, blamed for a lot of the sectarian violence that happened under his watch.
What do we know about what kind of paramilitary capacity he has now? Is he still in charge of a serious armed force?
Serious armed force is an interesting word. It is an armed force. The thing with Sadr's troops and Sadr's militia, which has had a variety of incarnations as he reinvents it, is that sometimes they will be out in the streets, sometimes they will be doing social organizational things like providing food and helping widows and orphans. So it is not a militia that now has a visible, if you're an ordinary Iraqi citizen, military presence, although it is part of the popular mobilization forces which sprung up after 2014 to fight ISIS. But it's a group that always has those weapons and that armed capability waiting in the wings, as it were.
He has created this image of being a somewhat both forbidding and elusive character. Is this something that works for him? Is this something that gives him political leverage? I guess what I'm asking is, are we looking at some sort of maybe Ayatollah Khomeini-like personality cult?
That's a really interesting thing. Sadr, first of all, is not only an Iraqi nationalist, he is someone who has an uneasy relationship with Iran, and he does not believe, as Iranian religious leaders do, that this should be a country run by religious leaders. So there's a key difference there. But in terms of personality, certainly he's seen as a charismatic figure. And I think the difficulty we have with that is that it's hard to explain and hard even to understand at times the appeal of religion, which is overlaid over politics. So his followers, and there are vast numbers of his followers, would do anything for him. In the polling stations on Sunday, I met some of the Sutterists in Sutter City voting for him. And there was actually an election official who said, if Sayed Muqtada asked me to jump off the roof, I would jump off the roof. As you know, that doesn't come from any sort of rational reckoning. It is a visceral loyalty to this family, which is revered. And revered not only for what they do now, what they've done for generations, revered because there is a belief that this will help them in the next life as well.
Which I guess brings us to the big question concerning Muqtada al-Sadr, which is, what does he want now? Which is to ask, what kind of country does he want Iraq to be? And what kind of role does he want to play in that? Because I guess another possible difference between him and an Ayatollah Khomeini figure, if he has any ardent desire to actually run the place himself, he's been quite quiet about that so far.
Yes, and that's the thing about his fascinating political career and his continued reinvention of himself. He is now not just a militia leader, he is a political leader who occasionally decides and announces, I'm not going to be in politics, and takes his people out of the political system, and then he puts them back in. But there are some things that are constant about him. One is that he believes that Iraq should be for Iraqis, and we've seen that demonstrated. He tries to keep Iranian influence at bay in the same way he keeps U.S. influence at bay. He is someone who has pledged the same principles that we saw among protesters 2 years ago when thousands of young people gathered in squares in Baghdad and across the south, tens of thousands, and hundreds of them died at the hands of security forces because they were demanding fundamental change in Iraq's political system. Muqtada Sadr is also calling for that change. I mean, he's part of the political system, but he wants to dismantle it. And he calls for a government full of technocrats, a government that at the end of the day delivers public services to their people. I mean, that's a shocking concept here. So those things have remained constant, but he does take contradictory positions. And that is part of the problem with seeing him, as the West does to some extent, as either an ally or an enemy.
Jane Arraf with the New York Times in Baghdad. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. And finally, on today's show, I'm joined by Dr. Renard Mansour, Senior Research Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa Program and Project Director of the Iraq Initiative at Chatham House. Renard, let's start with the question of turnout. It was very low, about 41%. So one of the challenges awaiting the new Iraqi government, whoever it turns out to be, will be to try and entrench some sense of legitimacy. How can they do that?
Well, this has been the big story in Iraq for many years now. A growing portion of the population does not believe in the political system that was set up in 2003. If you look at the turnout in the first Iraqi election, the first one after regime change, it was almost 80%. It was very high. But each time, with every election that passes, the turnout has gone lower and lower. And that is because a growing Iraqi population doesn't feel that this government can provide the basic services, their basic needs for their daily lives. They think that elections in themselves have just proven to be a reinforcement of the same cast of characters. Iraq has gone through so many different types of conflicts since 2003, yet there's been no accountability, there has been no reform, and the same leaders continue to govern without any accountability.
The key figure, as we have been discussing earlier in the program, is, of course, Muqtada al-Sadr. And though he will not be the next prime minister of Iraq because he declined to stand as a candidate himself, he obviously is even more entrenched in the kingmaker role than he was after the last election. Do we know who he wants to govern Iraq? Who is his preferred prime minister?
Well, first of all, I think we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. He doesn't have a majority. He doesn't have enough to be able to form a government that he could actually run. Every time in Iraq, we've seen that the end result of government formation, notwithstanding elections, is consensus government. is negotiations back and forth. Now, you're right that the Sadrists have increased their seats and some of their competitors and opponents have lost some seats, which give them a bit more political power to in those negotiations. And as you say, the Sadrists have, in the last few years, developed an interesting technique, which is to put up independents, to put up these technocrats who are weak and not political, and instead to focus on the senior civil servants of the Iraqi state, to plant inside the Iraqi state powerful people who can then tell the ministers what to do or tell the prime minister what to do. So power in that way in Iraq has gone down, away from what we would think are the powerful people, to the second layer. And that's where the Sadrists focus, and that is their game. And so this allows them to have scapegoats, to move away from accountability when they fail, and allows them to continue governing de facto. So it's hard to say right now who the Sadrists will choose, because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter for the Sadrists. Their key criteria is they want a government at the top level that is weak, that is unable, but critically willing to do whatever they want when it comes to contracts, procurement, and the daily politics.
Do the Sadrists and Muqtadir al-Sadr, do they have any sense of responsibility to the Iraqi nation, or are they mostly just concerned with looking after their own people?
I mean, very clearly that has become the name of the game in Iraqi politics, particularly when the voter turnout is low. The reason why the Sadrists are doing so well is because they have the base that will vote. So an increasing portion of Iraq's population is no longer voting. And keep in mind that a lot of Iraq's population is under the age of 25. Two-thirds are under 25. They do not remember anything before 2003. And so the Sadrists are sticking to their base. If you look at this past summer, the two biggest news stories from Iraq in terms of corruption and harm on society, one has been the hospital fires that have killed over 100 people in Baghdad and Nasiriyah in COVID-19 patient wards. The health ministry is largely seen as a Sadrist ministry. The other big story has been the lack of electricity, especially as, you know, the heat gets up to over 50 degrees this summer. Again, another ministry that is a Sadrist ministry. The Sadrists are playing just like every other political party. They generate revenue from the Iraqi government, from the Iraqi state, and they share it among their own patronage to ensure that when elections do come, they have a base that can vote. That money doesn't trickle down to most people, and even that process of corruption harms Iraqis.
If we reflect on those huge protests, which were one of the reasons, or actually the real reason, that this election was brought forward 6 months, one of the things the protests were about were this sectarian logjam that you describe. Indeed, also, though the comparison doesn't quite fit perfectly, but echoes of Lebanon there as well. Is there any realistic prospect of that changing? Is anybody going to end up in a position in the next Iraqi government, whatever it is, to actually get across the idea and make it stick that this is one country, we do all live here, and we do need to find a way to make this work?
I think if there's one lesson that we've learned in the last few years after, you know, these popular protests emerged, calling for real reform to that political system, the one lesson that we've learned is the political system is incredibly resilient. And it can outlast protest. Not just outlast protest, but it has stomped on protest. You've seen for the last few years a systematic campaign of violence that has targeted activists, that have targeted leaders who could mobilize. You no longer have protests in Iraq in public squares because the system has stopped that. It's targeted any individual who could potentially mobilize in the squares. You've had the killing of many activists, the jailing of many activists across the south in Baghdad. So we've learned that the political system is resilient and it's here to stay. And protesters who emerged in 2019 calling for a change to that system have been silenced. And usually our conversation is very pessimistic or negative and critical, but there is a kind of, in my conversations with protesters and some of civil society activists this week, if you look at the election result, there are some positive signs. For example, some seats have gone to parties that came out of the protest movements. Also, there are a few, not all, but a few independents that are themselves surprised that they somehow won votes and are now in the parliament. The third highest personal vote went to a leader of the protest movements. So what you have is this loose coalition of protest-minded, reform-minded, truly independents who are now going to go into the parliament. But the question becomes, what happens during that very nasty horse trading government formation process? Can these protest coalitions stay together? They will be attacked. There will be the big bosses coming after them, and they will be isolated. To answer your question of, is there any signs of hope from the protest? We'll have to see whether this loose coalition of very weak but driven reform-minded protest leaders now going into parliament, whether they'll be able to withstand very strong political forces.
You spoke of that system being incredibly resilient, if perhaps vexingly so. Is it possible to say the same, though, about Iraq as a country? It really isn't very long since a huge swath of it was conquered by an extremely or relatively lightly armed terrorist cult that you wouldn't have thought should pose any kind of threat to a serious country with a serious military. Is Iraq still existentially vulnerable?
I think that if you look at where ISIS is today, it was militarily defeated. It was territorially defeated. But the roots that led to the rise, to the surprisingly rise of just a few thousand Salafi jihadi fighters, those roots have not been addressed. Those socioeconomic, political challenges that you have in many Iraqi provinces and localities have not been addressed. So where the memory of ISIS, the traumatic history of what ISIS did in its very few years, is still very real, still very vivid in many Iraqis in those areas. In my travels to those areas, every year, more and more, you begin to see increasing disenfranchisement. You begin to say, from the day of our liberation, some tell me, from the day of our liberation until today, we still haven't seen our government. All we've seen are new militias, new armed groups, and more conflict. So that is to say that Iraq's history since 2003 has been cyclical. It hasn't been this linear progress towards a stronger state or a more coherent state or a democratic state, but it's been cyclical where you have mission accomplished. And every U.S. president has famously declared some kind of mission accomplished in Iraq, and then for that mission or that accomplishment to fall apart because the social roots have never been addressed. And again, we're here in 2021 talking about how some of these roots are yet to be addressed.
Just finally, let's attempt to cling on to that faint sliver of optimism that you were discussing there. But between now and the next Iraqi election, whenever that might be, what is a reasonable best-case scenario? How good could it get?
Oh, that's a difficult question to ask someone who is looking at very critical academic studies of the Iraqi state. But to me, the best-case scenario is if these few protest parties and independents can withstand the immense pressure, can be protected, cannot be assassinated, and can actually form an opposition. Not to go into the parliament, not to be part of the consensus government that every other group has done since 2003, but to say, we don't want a piece of the pie. We're going to show up every day to parliament and act as an accountability mechanism against the elite. That hasn't happened yet. That's been attempted. They're incredibly vulnerable. But to me, the hope is really in the youth. And young Iraqis are fed up with the system, and they have been proving willing to put their lives on the line to try and bring about change. So to me, that would be a kind of, from now to the next election, whether you could have some kind of civil society activity outside of government connected to these parliamentarians who can truly become an opposition, which has been missing in Iraq since 2003.
Renard Mansour, thank you very much, as always, for joining us on the Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.